everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party and Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and organize and advocate around the eco-socialist platform that Angela Walker and I ran on. So it's December 31st. I hope you're having a good holidays. And I thought I'd do a little year in review to start the discussion today. Talk about the attempted coup, climate, COVID, and Ukraine. So we got the January 6th report on Trump's coup last week. And this week we got the tax returns from Trump that were released by the Congress, the House, after getting that approved by the courts. So we have massive evidence now that Trump and his circle attempted a coup after losing the 2020 presidential election. Now, the question now is Merrick Garland at DOJ actually going to bring Trump and his inner circle to justice? Or is it going to be like, you know, after the meltdown, financial meltdown in 2008, where lots of people lost their homes that were stolen by the big banksters who were never brought to account? And that was a matter of policy by the Obama administration. The question now is whether the big guys are going to get prosecuted as well. And we'll wait to see. But I think there's going to be some consequence, but it probably won't be what's really deserved. We'll have to see. And what we've learned from the Trump tax returns so far is he was lying about being audited. And the IRS, which is supposed to audit presidential tax returns, didn't audit them the first 2 years as required by law. I mean, that's a scandal in itself. The IRS has as few of people working for it as it did in 1970. So it just really can't do the audits. And the rich folks are getting away with lots of tax cheating. The other thing we learned is, you know, we knew this, but now it's confirmed by the tax returns that Trump lost more money than any other American in a number of years. And just exposed, if anybody still believed it, that he's not a great businessman. So I would just say that, you know, Trump's star seems to be fading somewhat. But within the Republican Party, the anti-democratic authoritarian streak is alive and well and remains a danger. And, you know, people that say, well, there's no difference between the Democrats and Republicans. Yeah, there is. The Democrats are not attacking liberal democratic rights, you know, free speech, honest elections, and so forth. The Republicans are. That doesn't mean that we support the Democrats and they have answers, but I think it's a mistake to underestimate the danger on the right. So we've got to be organizing against that. So, you know, that brings us to the 2022 midterms. And the Democrats only held their own pretty much because of the abortion rights issue, which, you know, the Supreme Court repealed Roe v. Wade, and Republicans were doubling down on that with various laws in the states they control. And, you know, the majority of voters rebelled against that. And that spilled over into the Democratic vote. That saved their little behinds, because otherwise they were moving to the right. They were taking people of color and poor people and working class voters for granted in attempting to appeal to the swing vote in the suburbs. And so when the Republicans fear-mongered about crime, the Democrats said, okay, we're going to advocate, we're going to put more money into policing instead of crime prevention through anti-poverty and economic assistance programs. And when it came to immigrants, the Republicans are fear-mongering, and the Democrats accepted the Republican narrative that the border crisis is a security issue, not a humanitarian crisis. And they've continued Trump-era policies of asylum bans, ramped up prosecutions, and expedited deportations, including right now they're planning how to continue these inhumane immigration policies if Title 42 is ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Now, that may not happen, and the Trump or the Biden administration is trying to get it overturned. Title 42 said we can expel people because of the COVID crisis without giving them due process for immigration and asylum. But the Biden administration's figuring out how to do the same thing without Title 42, which means they've basically taken over the Republican program on immigration. And then the Republicans are whining like crazy about COVID public health measures, including vaccination and mask mandates. And what did the Democrats do? They tailed the Republicans. They followed them and withdrew their support for mandates in the schools and public transportation in particular. And we're about to pay for this surrender to the right. We got epidemiologists predicting this week that we're going to have up to 8,000 COVID deaths a week in the U.S. by mid-January. And of course, over in China, where they just totally did a reversal and they don't have the hospital capacity, they're expecting, the epidemiologists are saying 1 to 2 million deaths in China this year. It's a disaster. And also the, well, I'll get to COVID in a minute, but you know, we just got to put this in perspective. The Republicans have the most extreme, unpopular policies in the history of major party politics in the U.S. I mean, they want to cut Social Security and Medicare. And, you know, of course, there's the abortion issue. The Democrats should be able to landslide them. But instead, the Democrats won't push the popular economic class issues like raising the minimum wage, restoring the expanded child tax credit that was in place during the COVID emergency, and Medicare for all. So the Democrats are not giving their base among people of color and working class people a reason to come out and vote for them. The Democrats are answering to their donor base, not their base of voters. And so turnout is low and the Republicans win a lot more races than they should. And what that does is basically let the Republicans set the terms of debate around their scapegoating culture wars. So again, that's why we need a progressive mass-based party like the Green Party is trying to be. And in COVID, as I mentioned, you know, they've cut the public health measures, which means COVID's resurging again this winter. And they cut the funding from the federal government for free vaccines. And a lot of people are not getting the boosters that became available this fall, which deal with the Omicron as well as the original virus. And they eliminated the vaccine mandate for service members, but not the other mandates. I mean, people, when they get into service, they go down a row and they get punched in each shoulder as they get a whole bunch of vaccinations as they walk down the row there, but not COVID. And of course, I mentioned the removal of vaccine and mask mandates for schools and public transportation. It's funny, I hear these epidemiologists, these doctors talking about how they travel, they go on airplanes, they're the only ones wearing masks. It's, you know, and Biden didn't help by declaring the pandemic over. And he's not saying nothing right now that I've heard as the COVID infections start spiking up again. We've never got the OSHA standards to address the COVID issue. Things like masking and ventilation requirements at work. I know the National Nurses United are up in arms about that because they're frontline workers on that, but if the government has failed on that. And so as we face this new surge, there are reports now that there's shorter beds in California due to what they call the triple epidemic of flu, SRV, and COVID. And, you know, to us, that just reiterates and underscores the need to replace our private healthcare system with a community-controlled national health service, not just national health insurance to pay for the cost, but public ownership of the hospitals and other healthcare facilities so we can manage them in a way that they have the capacity to deal with epidemics like we're dealing with right now. And then climate, CO2 rose again in 2022 to new record levels. the current national goals of the various countries for carbon emissions reduction, if they're followed, and that's a big question, will only cut carbon emissions by 7% by 2030. And this is when the International Panel on Climate Change says they must be cut by 45% by 2030 in order to have just a 50-50 chance of keeping the temperature rise below the goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius. The remaining carbon budget to have a 50-50 chance of staying of reaching that 1.5 degree goal is going to be exhausted in 10 years at current rates of emission. I mean, we're right on the precipice. And global temperatures have already risen 1.2 degrees Celsius. 350 parts per million is considered the safe limit for stabilizing global temperatures, but the National Oceanic and Aeronautics Administration, their reading yesterday, I looked it up, was 419 parts per million. It's 70 parts per million over what's considered safe. You know, it's about 20% higher than we should be. I mean, we're already past where we should be. And every day there's more news about climate breakdown. Yesterday, a study was released showing that Greenland ice is melting 100 times faster than previously believed. And then we had the COP27, the International Climate Summit in November, and it was underwhelming. You know, they did acknowledge, finally, the U.S. and the other rich countries that they need to account and pay for damage and loss in the countries, particularly in the global south, that are suffering from climate change. But there was no money allocated. They're going to talk about that down the road. It kicked things down the road all the time. And binding fossil fuel emission cuts were delayed again. So there was some good news. I mean, the climate deniers in office in big countries like Trump in the U.S., Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Morrison in Australia lost their presidential elections. But all that did was maybe slow the reckless acceleration of global heating as a matter of policy in these countries. But climate policies to seriously reduce carbon emissions are not on the agenda of any of these countries. One other good thing is that Europe really accelerated their move to green energy as a consequence of Russia's war in Ukraine. And although it didn't this year, it's going to lead to significant cuts in gas and especially coal in the next few years. But even in Europe, and especially the rest of the world, still not moving anywhere near fast enough to cut global emissions by 50% by 2030 to have a 50-50 chance of reaching 1.5 degrees Celsius. And, you know, the other part of that 50-50 chance is we have to get to net zero emissions by 2050. And it's just not in the plans of the various countries. The Biden administration claims with their Inflation Reduction Act, which I call the Build Back Badly Act, because it opens the door to all kinds of new fossil fuel development projects. I mean, their claims of a 50% cut by 2030 are just bogus. They have models that some academics and think tanks have done, but they all assume very unrealistically that there'll be massive action by the private industry sector and state and local governments. And that's just not happening. The International Energy Agency has said that by their calculations, no new fossil fuel projects should be developed starting last year, 2022, if we're going to reach zero emissions by 2050. And just 20 of the world's largest oil and gas companies like Shell and Exxon and Russia's Gazprom, are projected to spend nearly $1 trillion, $932 billion by the end of 2030, developing new oil and gas fields. So, you know, we just don't have a handle on this crisis. And it's up to us to build militant climate movements for a serious eco-socialist global Green New Deal. And, you know, we just can't wait or accept that, you know, the lesser evil beating these greater evils like Trump and Bolsonaro and Morrison is going to get it done. And then finally, you know, the big thing, one of the big things this year was Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And unfortunately, the left and the peace movement are confused about this. Some of those groups seem more interested in cutting arms to the Ukraine national liberation struggle than in cutting arms to Saudi Arabia for its deadly military intervention in Yemen, or cutting arms to Israel as part of the BDS movement as the most extremely racist and annexationist Israeli government yet is coming into power. These are demands we could be raising that could have a real impact. There have been resolutions before Congress to stop the arms to Saudi Arabia for the war in Yemen, and it's going to come back up in 2023, and support for BDS is growing, although it's not likely to pass. Cutting off arms to Israel is likely to pass in Congress soon. We can be building a lot of pressure around that. Instead, a lot of these groups are obsessed with calling an invasion by Russia of Ukraine a U.S. proxy war on Russia. And they seem more interested in supporting the Russian imperialist camp against the U.S.-led imperialist camp than in supporting national liberation struggles. And, you know, I really think this is a test for the American left and the international left. Is the left going to support the oppressed in their struggles for liberation? Or is it going to take sides in an inter-imperialist rivalry, joining one camp over the other? And this question is not just in play in Ukraine. It's in play in Syria, in Iran, where some of these groups say the uprising by the women and the people against not just the hijab, but the repression and lack of democracy is fostered by the West. Myanmar, where, you know, the coasters there, the military regime is backed by Russia and China. So these groups say, well, you know, this is also CIA sponsored uprising by the people of Myanmar. Or in Sudan, where they've had a popular revolution, they've kind of come to a stalemate with the military, but now the military's fighting back and the Russians are back in the military there. Where is the left supporting the popular movement for democracy in Sudan? And I could go through a whole lot of other countries. But the question for the left is, are we going to be against all imperialisms and for the struggles of the oppressed? Or are we going to get wrapped up in this geopolitical inter-imperialist rivalry and alienate these popular movements for liberation from the left? And they're going to turn to the West in this case, because at least the Western imperialists mouth support for democracy, although they contradict it in most of the countries they operate in. So a lot of the people on the, we could call it the campus left, the alt-imperialists, talk about a multipolar world emerging that will supposedly give space for socialist movements and states to develop. But the problem is all the states in the world are capitalist and they're competing. It's an inter-imperialist fight. And when we don't support these liberation movements, we force the people fighting for the liberation to choose one imperialist camp or the other. And this is an issue not just for our left and our peace movement here in the United States, but it's international. I'm gonna put a article in the chat by Kavita Krishnan, which is entitled Multipolarity, the Mantra of Authoritarianism. And although she's for a multipolar world, it's for a multipolar socialist world, not a multipolar inter-imperialist capitalist world. And Krishnan is probably the leading Indian feminist, certainly of her generation. Until recently, she was a member of the Politburo of the Communist Party of India, Marxist-Leninist, which is one of the three major communist parties there and the one most to the left. But she resigned over its lukewarm and confused solidarity with Ukraine. So I urge you to read this article, and it, I think, brings out the issues the left and the anti-war movement faces, because capitalism generates imperialist expansion, not just by the United States, but all the capitalist countries, particularly the bigger ones. Capitalism is a global system and imperialism is embedded in it. And it requires an international socialist revolution to overcome global capitalism. And that's why international socialist solidarity is so important and why I'm emphasizing that. So those are some reflections on the year we've just had and what it means for the year coming up. So I'm looking forward to your questions and comments. Kevin Sanchez, agree about election denialism, attempted coups, but Democrats suppress the Green Party in the ways the Republicans did not do to the Republican, to the Libertarian Party. Wouldn't you agree? I would agree that the Democrats have been more aggressive and maybe ahead of the Republicans, but the Republicans are starting in several states to go after the Libertarian Party the way the Democrats have gone after the Green Party. So neither party is really about democracy. They use democracy and election integrity as a cover for their suppression of their competitors politically. And that's as anti-democratic as you can get. Santino Musto, question. Do you think the Greens will see the open seat dynamic that helped Stein and Nader anytime soon with Trump and DeSantis leading the GOP? I suspect Vote Blue to Stop MAGA dynamic will plague third parties for a while yet. Have a happy and healthy 23. Thank you. And the same to everybody on this podcast. I don't think we'll see the open seat dynamic. Even if Biden decides not to run, because the far right Republicans, whether Trump is leading the way, or I think more likely somebody like DeSantis or somebody else, you know, that we really are looking at now, the Republican Party is a far right, anti-democratic, racist, authoritarian party. And the Democrats will use that to scare people into voting for the lesser evil. It's a issue we face, which is why if I were to run again in 2024, I would add a fourth theme to the three themes I ran on in 2020. Now, those themes were the Green New Deal, the Economic Bill of Rights, and peace policies. And we got to add to that inclusive democracy, including not just the voting rights, which still haven't been fixed in terms of the Voting Rights Act, but ranked choice voting, particularly proportional ranked choice voting for legislative bodies, and fair ballot access. Without those things, you know, we have a farce. We have gerrymandered districts. 95% of state legislative districts, over 90% of House districts are non-competitive. Those elections are farcical. We know who's going to win before the election even happens, because one major party or the other has the overwhelming majority in those districts, and they draw the lines through gerrymandering to make sure that's the case. With proportional representation, doesn't matter how the lines are drawn. You're electing people from multi-member districts, and each party gets its proportional share of representation according to the vote it receives. So that's how to really get rid of gerrymandering. These nonpartisan independent redistricting commissions are marginal in improving more competitive districts. I mean, I was debating somebody on another format recently about California, and they have, I think, 52 members of the House, and they had an independent redistricting commission, but only five of those seats had a margin of victory of less than 5%. In other words, they were decisive victories for one party or the other. They were not competitive. So even the independent redistricting commissions don't get us competitive districts and real elections. That's why we got to go to proportional representation, which will get rid of gerrymandering as well as the spoiler problem. Then people can vote for who they want without worrying about helping their worst enemy. Via email, thoughts on George Santos. You know, where the hell were the Democrats down there on Long Island doing their opposition research? I mean, this guy lied about everything about himself. And he's probably going to be seated, and he's already pledged his vote to Kevin McCarthy to be the next speaker. So, you know, he's going to be seated. And, you know, I guess in the Trump era of misrepresentation of yourself, we should have expected more people like this guy. But I think on Long Island, the Republicans hate him now as much as the Democrats do. So he's going to be a one-term member of Congress. But, you know, what a farce. And it never should have happened. The Democrats were asleep at the wheel because they didn't, you know, investigate this guy and find out he was lying about everything about himself. I would add, as well as Santos's primary competitors, they didn't do their homework either. Santino Musto, question, would Medicare for All include Medicaid as well? Yeah, Medicaid would be incorporated into a, what we're calling for, a community-controlled national health service as the form of Medicare or healthcare for all. And so all the funds going into Medicaid, all the funds now going into Medicare, as well as the other funds we need to cover everybody, would go into one pot. It would be a single-payer program with the government paying for the medical services. But what we're talking about is not just paying the costs that private health insurance providers bill the government for, but bringing those providers and their facilities into a public system, which will be better for cost control, better for planning so that we have enough hospital beds when we have emergencies like I just described in California. And the system will be responsive. When we say community control, there'll be locally elected health boards, you know, metropolitan area, you know, rural regional area health boards. And those people elected to those boards will make sure the whole system is accountable to the people in their jurisdiction. And that will help with issues like the unequal distribution of healthcare resources between affluent and poor, often people of color communities, because those communities will have representation on the healthcare boards and be able to speak up for their needs. Zero Returns Gaming. Victorian election ballots are fully counted. Greens gain one house and three in the Senate. Oh, Victoria is in Australia. Okay, I guess this is the provincial elections. And the Australian Greens are gaining ground. And, you know, more power to them. I'm still hoping to get an Australian Green on this podcast to talk about the organizing they've been doing, because they've really done the kind of grassroots, consistent organizing. So while they get their fair share in the national Senate, because it has proportional representation, in the House, even though it's ranked choice voting for individual districts, they are now at 4 out of 151 members of the House, even though their vote, I think, was 12% nationwide for House seats. So that's why when we get to legislative bodies, we got to talk about proportional ranked choice voting from multi-member districts. Don't settle for ranked choice voting from single-member districts, or we're going to be way underrepresented. So congratulations to the Victorian Greens in Australia, and hopefully soon we'll get one of them on to talk about what they've been doing so we can learn from them. A. Ross, is there any coalition building going on with anyone? Does this party build up mutual aid funds for strike? Does this party build up mutual aid funds for strikers? The Green Party is uneven in that respect. We are stronger in some locals and states in, you know, being involved in the issues of our communities and states and working in coalition, and other places not so much. And this does include mutual aid funds for strikers. definitely, and just support for strikers and support for organizing. I mean, just me personally, I'm staying in touch with my former UPS workers. The Teamsters have a big contract with UPS coming up. Contract expires July 31st. Negotiations are going on now. And, you know, I'm in touch with them. So if they do go on strike, or if they do have demonstrations just to support contract demands, you know, I will be there and I will bring other Greens with me here in the Syracuse, New York area. Frankie Lee, how do we stop further privatization of Medicare and Medicaid? We got to run more Greens. You know, at the state level, that privatization is going on at the state level as well as the federal level. And we got a challenge because the Democrats are going along. The Biden administration, they appointed Liz Fowler, who wrote Obamacare, which is public subsidies for private insurance. She is now head of the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation. And her goal is to privatize all of Medicare and Medicaid so that everybody's put on a private Medicare Advantage managed care insurance plan. So they privatize the whole system. And that's the Democrats. Of course, the Republicans don't want to just privatize it. They want to just cut it all together or cut it back, you know, Medicare. I mean, it's unbelievable that the Republicans would even raise that. It's a totally unpopular demand. And, you know, Democrats, if they were smart, would jump on that and they'd get behind Medicare for all. But the answer to their donors, which include big pharma and the big private insurance companies. So I think a big part of this is, you know, we've got to be in the elections challenging the privatization, not just of Medicare and Medicaid, but now the VA, which is actually a national health service model. They own their hospitals. Their doctors work as public employees, not for, you know, for-profit organizations. So, you know, we got to raise it in every forum, but I think the missing forum, because there is a single-payer movement out there, but it's weak because it poses no threat to the Democrats losing votes because they won't go for Medicare for all. So I think, you know, the missing ingredient for this demand, as well as many other progressive demands, is an independent progressive party like the Green Party that, you know, is serious and can make run, you know, real campaigns in these races that will change the terms of debate, even if we don't win. And, you know, getting into the debate is half the battle, because once we start arguing these issues, we're on the winning side. The American people are with us on a lot of these issues already. So to me, that's what we got to do. You know, how do we stop it? We raise it in elections. That's the thing we need to add to the movement against privatization and for Medicare for all. Betty Dimmitt, or Beatty Dimmitt, how can single-payer healthcare be separated from single-payer education? We don't even rank in the top 60 anymore for the ratio of doctors to population. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, we have single-payer public education. Actually, we got multi-payer because while public education is funded by the public sector, we do have public sector money being siphoned off to private education through charter schools, for example. And, you know, Pell grants for people that go to private colleges, things like that. So it's a little different, but I think it's a good analogy. You know, we don't advocate that people buy, you know, education insurance plans so they can go to public schools. So single payer basically means the public pays, and it does for public education. It should for a public healthcare system. You know, and the ratio of doctors to population, yeah, it's pathetic. I talked to a doctor the other day. He has 5,000 patients he has to deal with. I mean, how can he keep track of all of them and keep up on, you know, he has to open up a computerized file every time just to figure out who he's talking to and what their problems are. It's ridiculous. You know, part of the single payer or the Medicare for All or National Health Service should be greatly expanding medical education so we have more doctors and nurses to deal with patients. Via email, thoughts on recent advances in fusion research. These are way overhyped. I mean, to get to fusion production of electricity, you know, the proponents say it's still decades away. It's been decades away my whole lifetime. This is also about nuclear weapons, hydrogen bombs, fusion bombs. And that's what the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory is really working on. So let's keep that in mind. And the other thing is we already have a fusion reactor. It's called the Sun. It provides solar radiation, which also in heating the planet creates wind, our two major sources of renewable energy. So we got the fusion reactor we need. So, and you know, by the time fusion, if it ever becomes feasible for the production of electricity for civilian purposes, decades down the road, it'll be too late to deal with the climate crisis. Solar and wind are available now. They're cheaper than any other form of new electricity, and that's what we need to build. And this whole fusion hyping is a diversion from that. And so let's not get diverted. The email, thoughts on what happened with Southwest Airlines over the holidays. Another failure of capitalist economics. You know, these are for-profit enterprises. They are not organized to deal with emergencies like this climate emergency and during the height of the holiday season. And Southwest melted down. We used to have a regulation of airline routes until the 1970s, and we didn't have these kind of problems. A lot of countries' airline system is, you know, nationalized. I think we should look at nationalization with worker and community control. So, you know, it just shows, you know, the apologists or the advertisers or publicists for capitalism say it's more efficient. Well, not really. We just saw that with Southwest Airlines. They completely failed. And so I think we should look at a much more regulated airline industry, if not a socially owned one. Frankie Lee, Howie, do you think the Dems could bring back the draft if they get desperate to send troops to Ukraine? No, they don't want the draft back. The military doesn't want the draft back because draftees don't want to fight a lot of these imperialist wars. And we're not sending troops to Ukraine. We're sending them weapons. The Ukrainians are fighting for themselves. So the Dems, you know, that's not even under discussion. I wouldn't worry about that. Jennifer Clark, maybe you should concentrate on leading small communities in every state instead of trying to insert yourself into a system that doesn't want you. We need to change the system, and it will never happen within the system. If you're saying that the Greens should emphasize politics at the local level, including elections, I agree. That's how we build a mass base. That's how we become relevant to grassroots voters who see us in our communities making a difference and standing up for the right things. Instead of relying on a presidential election, a gubernatorial election. Now, we do have reasons to run for those. Many of them related to ballot access, also related to the platform it provides to advance our analyses and policies. But the emphasis should be on building this thing from the bottom up. So whether that's within the system, I think it's using what's available to us, which includes elections, you know, the right to free speech and assembly, and to petition the government for grievances, those for redress of grievances, First Amendment rights. That's part of the system. That's part of the system we should use to change the system, basically from a capitalist system to a democratic socialist system, an eco-socialist system. And I emphasize eco-socialist because traditional socialism in the 19th century and the 20th century was about largely, in large part, about increasing production so we could end poverty. We have plenty of productive capacity now to end poverty. The problem now is producing what we need within ecological limits. And that's not why we need to talk about an ecological socialism to distinguish us from what socialism was emphasizing in the last two centuries. Violet at Content Boutique. Howie, what can we do to make public utilities publicly owned again? How can we fight privatization? Well, when electric utilities were first set up and gas utilities first set up, it was a big debate whether they should be publicly owned as natural monopolies or privately owned and publicly regulated. And, you know, the country was divided on that. So in different places, we went different ways. In New York, they went privatization. In Cleveland, they went public. In Los Angeles, they went public. And the publicly owned utilities have provided better service at lower cost and have generally moved more quickly into the green energy field. Privatization, I don't know of any privatization fights offhand, but I'm sure I'm missing some where they want to take a public utility and privatize it. I mean, the most, probably the best known example is when the private utilities and the banks in Cleveland wanted to privatize the municipal power company in Cleveland, and Dennis Kucinich, who was then called the boy mayor of Cleveland, was elected saying he would be against privatization. And what happened to him is the bank said, okay, if you won't play ball with us, we're going to not roll over the lines of credit that the city uses to, you know, meet its payroll and other ongoing expenses. Because taxes come in chunks, not in a steady stream. And they basically pushed the city toward bankruptcy, discredited Kucinich, and he lost the next election. But the utility wasn't privatized because this was in the high inflation period in the late 70s and early 80s. And it became impossible to finance privatization with those high interest rates. So the Cleveland Municipal Utility survived. And then the suburban utilities that wanted to take over the city public utility, their rates went up in the 70s, 80s, into the 90s. And the Cleveland municipal utility rates rose much more slowly, and to the point where it had saved Cleveland, city of Cleveland ratepayers. I forget the numbers. It was tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. So by the 90s, people were saying, thank you, Dennis Kucinich. And he was able to get himself elected to Congress based on that record, even though he was in the political wilderness for a couple decades. So that's just an example of where privatization was tried and failed. And no doubt the private utilities would like to take over municipal utilities where they exist. But it's difficult because municipal utilities are popular. I'm in the city of Syracuse. We're part of National Greed. That's National Grid, but we call it National Greed. Right next door to us is a village called Salve. It's basically an industrial village. It still has a steel plant and a lot of factories because its power is cheap. It's about a third what we pay just across the street in Syracuse. And anybody that proposed privatizing Salve Electric, which is owned by the city, would be considered out of their mind. We tried to use that to get public power in Syracuse and had some success in the early 2000s. Unfortunately, the Democratic mayor took a proposal that the city council passed to study municipalization and tried to turn it into a deal for Siemens to build a biofuels plant to power city government and school buildings. So the city council, and we urge them to do that, pulled the funding because for the study, because the mayor and the vendor that had been hired didn't want to move forward with the municipalization study as long as the mayor was pushing the Siemens deal. And that guy, that mayor, became head of Governor Cuomo's, one of his agencies that dealt with infrastructure. It just shows how corrupt the system is. So anyway, yeah, we should be pushing for public power big time. Because once we got public power, then we can force, or it's not force, it's our utility system. We can turn to green energy. Right now, we're fighting the private IOUs, investor-owned utilities, to move to renewables. And partly because they're cheaper, they're starting to move that way, but too slow. They don't want to abandon their existing infrastructure. So, for example, here in New York, we have a gas pipeline infrastructure that goes to the homes and businesses to heat them and, you know, to power the stoves for cooking. And instead of replacing gas with home heat pumps and induction stoves that are run by electricity and efficiently and would cost consumers less because they don't have to pay for the fuel. Over time, it would pay them less. The initial capital costs are high, and that should be publicly financed. Instead of doing that, they say, we're going to go green by producing hydrogen and putting it into the gas pipelines, a mix of gas and hydrogen. And they call that renewable fuel. It's just a plan to extend the life of fossil gas in our system of heating and cooking. So we're fighting the utilities on that. And, you know, in the state of New York, they just came out with this plan to implement a climate action plan that passed a few years ago. And they pushed this so-called renewable fuels system, which is, you know, disaster from the viewpoint of climate stabilization. That's what we got with privately owned utilities. If it was a public system, the public would choose the heat pumps and the induction stoves, financed by public, maybe by the utility itself, so that the things are installed, and then the consumer pays off the capital costs over time with their lower utility bills, lower because they're just paying for the electricity to run the heat pumps and stoves, and saving on the fuel costs. And over time, they can pay it back without their rates going up. That's what we should be doing. And the private IOUs, investor-owned utilities, are resisting, and we got to fight them. So we should be pushing for public power at the municipal level, at the state level, and, you know, really at the federal level. We should have federal enabling legislation that will incentivize taking over the whole utility industry and running it, again, in a community-controlled manner, locally elected public utility district boards that federate at the state and national level for overall coordination. Violet at Content Boutique. Utility companies just succeeded in wiping out net metering for solar here in California. Exactly. And, you know, that damn governor, that Democrat who may be running if Biden doesn't, or maybe even if he does, Gavin Newsom, at the same time, he sided with the utilities in reducing the costs of net metering that producers of electricity in their homes get. He provided more subsidies to continue running Diablo Canyon nukes, which sit on an earthquake zone. They're old nukes. Their piping and equipment is brittle because of the radiation. You know, if that earthquake that had happened up by Humboldt had happened down by Diablo Canyon, LA might be being evacuated because of radiation coming down from Diablo Canyon. Gavin Newsom, if you recall, he lost on election day to Matt Gonzalez, a Green. This, I think, was 2003. And Newsom, after he and the Green, Matt Gonzalez, were in the runoff, had the backing of both the Democratic and Republican parties. Gavin Newsom comes from a landlord family, a developer family, and the Republicans and the Democrats got behind him. All the big, you know, name Democrats from Bill Clinton, the Jesse Jackson came out to support Gavin Newsom. But Matt won on election day with the people that voted that day. Then they counted the paper ballots and Newsom came out ahead. And it was a remarkable swing because the paper ballots didn't reflect the election day voting. And I have always wondered, even though San Francisco Greens never made an issue of it, whether the Democrats and Republicans who controlled the election machinery didn't stuff ballots in order to elect Gavin Newsom instead of Matt Gonzalez. I have no evidence for that other than it sure was strange that all the, you know, most of the paper, the absentee ballots were for Newsom, whereas most of the people voting on election day were for Gonzalez. So anyway, I don't like Gavin Newsom, and unfortunately, he could be the next Democratic presidential candidate. And, you know, the other thing he hasn't done is ban fracking in California. It's been a big movement for that. He's been against that. He vetoed an instant runoff voting enabling legislation at the state level. I mean, with Democrats like that, who needs Republicans? So, yeah, Violet, thanks for reminding us of that sorry story. At war with dust. After losing the Democratic primary, Democratic Party primary, if Bernie Sanders had run as a Green presidential candidate in 2016, would the political landscape be better or worse today? I think it would be better if we'd been able to follow up with organizing in the wake of that election. Bernie, you know, was a national figure. He would have got a bigger vote than Stein. And it would have been significant. Now, it might have been the margin of difference and ended up making it clearer that the third party helped Trump get elected, given our winner-take-all presidential elections instead of instant runoff voting and the Electoral College. Remember, Trump lost the popular vote, but the Electoral College put him over the top because of his bias toward the more conservative rural white states. Bernie would have been able to give more voice to the progressive sentiment in this country, which is at least a third of the country. I mean, when I look at the polls, I see about a third are solidly progressive, about a third are, you know, batshit crazy Republican right. You know, they believe in all kinds of conspiracy nonsense. And then there's a middle, which isn't so ideologically, developed or committed. They just want government to work. And that's why the Democrats should be wiping out the Republicans, because the Republicans got nothing to promote a government that works. But the Democrats really don't want to either, because their corporate funders don't want the kind of policies that would make government work for the people. So, yeah, if Bernie had run as a Green, I think we'd be in a different political landscape. Certainly the debate would have been much different. I mean, that terrible debate between Trump and Clinton, just think of the things Sanders would have brought into the debate, like Medicare for all, and, you know, wipe the floor with Clinton and Trump on that question. It would have changed the terms of debate. And it's, you know, Bernie made up his mind before the election. He never would have gotten into the Democratic primaries if he hadn't promised to support the Democratic nominee, which he assumed would be Clinton like everybody else. He just wanted to raise some issues. They never would have let him on the ballots of the Democratic Party. He's not registered as a Democrat. They would have found ways to just keep him out. But once he promised to support whoever the Democratic nominee is, and everybody assumed it would be Clinton, then all right, Bernie, you know, we'll put you on stage and you can appeal to the progressives, and then we can count on them. We can take them for granted in November. And I think so Bernie made the mistake before he even ran in the Democratic primaries. Now, if he'd run as a Green, he'd had to fight for ballot access. He'd had to fight to get into the debates. It's a question whether the mass of people that got behind him would have heard about him and got behind and really organized organically from the bottom up, bigger than his own campaign could do. That's what happened in 2016. That could have happened if he ran as an independent. It could have happened even bigger than running in the Democratic primary, because people we know from the polls do want another alternative. So, you know, it's a hypothetical. We don't know exactly what would have happened, but I would say the political landscape today would be better. The email, advice for Greens going in 2023. Get involved in your community struggles. Start looking for local elections, which happened in a lot of places in 2023. And in the 2024 state legislative elections and congressional elections. And start getting organized now. You know, start thinking about who would be a good candidate, what you need to run a serious campaign, and fight back. I mean, people got to get off the couch, get from behind the computer screen all the time, and get out and talk to people, do public activities that support our policies, support our demands, and carry that into elections. That's the only way we're going to, you know, make inroads into legislative bodies where then we have a permanent seat, a permanent platform to continue raising our issues and win more people to our side. So I think that's one piece of advice. Another is raise the profile of ranked choice voting, especially proportional ranked choice voting for legislative bodies. We're making great strides on that. Going into 2020, we just had a couple dozen local jurisdictions that were using ranked choice voting. Now we have over 100 because we've won it in many localities and at the state level in most recently in Nevada, which added something like 20 counties, maybe 17 counties, 20 municipalities, and 19 school districts, in addition to the statewide offices. So we're making great strides. It's a reform we can win. It's popular. Once people use it, they like it. So I think that's one of the emphases we should be putting. The time seems to be right for that. People, given the background of, you know, an attempted coup, and voter suppression and absence of voting rights, we need to advance the struggle for democracy, including voting rights. And we should, you know, never let the voters forget that the Democrats had both houses of Congress and they didn't get voting rights passed in this last session that's ending today, I guess. At least the 117th Congress is going to end in a day or two. They had both houses, but they let the Senate filibuster, which means the Republicans veto basic voting rights. So the Democrats, you know, maybe they want to keep that on the table as something they can campaign on in the future. But we need voting rights now. And beyond that, fair elections where every party gets its fair and proportional share of representation in government. And the Democrats, as well as the Republicans, are against that. That's our issue. So it should be one of our leading issues. And we can raise that in cities, towns, counties, states, school districts, as well as at the federal level. So I think that's one of the issues I think we should emphasize. Along with climate, healthcare, Medicare for all is enormously popular. I mean, we got the issues, but people aren't going to know about it or support us if we're not out there active in issue campaigns between elections and then in the elections with our own candidates. I guess that was meant to be the last question. Good last question as we enter 2023 in 8 hours here on the East Coast. And thanks for showing up on the holidays. Next week, we're going to have a presentation by David Schwartzman, who's a professor emeritus in biogeochemistry, I think is what he worked on, from Howard University. He's one of the leading eco-socialists in the world. And we're going to talk about the degrowth question and eco-socialism and what degrowth means for eco-socialism. And David has a presentation that I think will be very informative. And I hope everybody will be there and hopefully more. I know some people are on the holiday. But so that's next week, January 7th. And so let's let's get active in this new year and start advancing what we stand for. So have a happy new year, and we'll see you next year, next week.